Podcast with a K. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my great honour to tell you that I'll tell you what happened. Right, this morning I got some notifications from my LinkedIn account, which doesn't normally happen unless I posted something, and I hadn't posted anything. So I checked out, and it seemed that my status was revealing that I was celebrating 10 years at the Podcast with a K.
Wow.
Now, we did mention this a few months ago, but it's June that Brian and I launched our very first podcast on the old website that shall not be named. Which we called the Podcast with a K. And it's 10 years since Brian. It's a shame Brian's not with us this week for a little bit of podcast recollections. But so 10 years we've been doing this. And James has been with us since 2011, I think.
Probably.
Yeah. So that's 6 years.
Horrific.
Which is long enough. Yeah.
Horrific.
someone mentioned to me on Twitter that they'd listened to us rambling on about Doctor Who more than they'd listened to their own family.
Horrific.
So hello, anyway. Happy 10th anniversary, dear podcaster. Dear listener, beg your pardon. I'm sure there must be one or two of you out there who were with us at the beginning. Actually, thinking back to the first one, there probably isn't. It wasn't great. So, The Lie of the Land, which, you know, it's a good title. It has to be said, and it does have some good aspects to it. Brian isn't here, as mentioned. As you can hear, James is here. James McLean, hello.
Hello.
Hello. So we're going to have a chat about Lie of the Land and a couple of other things that have happened tangentially related to Doctor Who in the last few days. Brian's not here. He's emailed us his thoughts of The Lie of the Land. I'm not sure whether we should read them or not. What do you think?
Well, isn't that the whole point?
Yeah, I know, but that's what everyone's expecting. Now I've said that there's an email of Brian, everyone's expecting us to read it.
Well, have you got him to record it?
No, I haven't, no.
So that's what I should have done. Our options are limited here to either ignore it, which I think Brian might be a little upset by, or read it and do what we've suggested we could do. I don't think there is a third option here.
Actually, if he had recorded it, then I could do a sort of over-the-shoulder shot of me reading it with his voice over the top of it.
We could ask the listener to guess what he wrote. Bear in
mind... He doesn't mention Stephen Moffat once. Oh, no, he does. Sorry.
Yes. Okay. So
we'll come back to that in a bit.
Okay, right. Okay. This is... structured as usual. Carry on.
Foreshadowing. Yeah, of course it's structured. What do you take me for? The Lie of the Land obviously is the third part of a kind of loose but obvious trilogy of stories featuring the Doctor against...
Why is it loose? I don't understand that.
They keep calling it loose, don't they?
It's not at all. It's absolutely all connected. I mean, you don't say Lord of the Rings was three loose DVDs worth of... Tolkien. They were connected. Yeah, they had different places and different emphasis, but they were connected. Yes. Not loose in any way whatsoever.
I'm not arguing with you. I agree. Good. Completely. The Lie of the Land, the Truth Monks. Do you know what? Actually, I think what we should do, before we go into the story, let's go into the Truth Monks, okay? Because... obviously, we were talking in the last podcast quite a bit about what the Truth Monks might be. Who are the Truth Monks? And you were saying that you would prefer it if they were not Time Lords or Cybermen, because you'd like something new. I think that I'm paraphrasing.
Probably. I don't remember ever what I say, but yeah, that sounds like
okay.
Me.
Would you agree with that now, after seeing what the Truth Monks actually are?
I don't know what the Truth Monks are. They're
well,
nothing.
Yeah,
they're just a load of contradictions depending on the episode. In each episode, they're entirely different. There's nothing that really connects them at all. I mean, in the first one, they're sort of almost like making a threat that they're going to come and take the Earth. In the second one, they're not really taking the Earth. They're going to sort of become part, they're going to become the powers of the Earth for the people, which isn't really sort of suggested in the first one. And then in the third one, I don't really know what they were doing. They just seemed to be ambling around quite pleasantly, really, doing nothing at all. And everyone else was shooting each other. It just, there was just nothing that really connected. There was no sort of, you didn't really get a feeling of what they were at all. And I think that was probably the biggest disappointment. No, it was one of the biggest disappointments. One of the many disappointments. One of the
Their motivation seemed to be purely conquest for the sake of conquest, didn't it?
Well, it did. But then the way they could conquest didn't seem to carry any logic either. They seemed to have more power when they didn't have consent than when they actually had consent, while they still had a lot of power then.
Mm.
And that's what I sort of found. I mean, in the first one, you get this, and we did say in the first, when we did the first podcast on extremists, that we were open to the fact that some of these things could be explained. But no, they did actually have the ability to map the entirety of space and time to some degree. Because there was never anything which sort of argued about how that they knew the Doctor would move from to the future, become blinded. They knew the interior of the TARDIS. They knew how the sonic screwdrivers were. All this was mapped into that story. So unless you take it as a bit of a sort of iron, that the audience has to sort of just suspend disbelief a bit and just accept that's just the way that the story's being told. And it's a conceit. And all that that we see is not actually part of the virtual reality. They have massive power there. Which is then sort of slightly echoed in the second one, where they seem to have fairly massive power there, where they can make people teleport from the sky. And probably the biggest massive power they show is that they cure the Doctor's blindness, where clearly his regenerative powers cannot, which is an incredible amount of power these enemies have in that episode, isn't it? That's a really big thing, bigger than anything I think we've seen. You know, the Doctor can't himself change his blindness. I got the impression, even if he regenerated, he'd probably be blind, because you'd think that would have sort of been mooted as a possibility. It just seemed to be, and yet they could just do it because she wished it, they could make it happen. Yeah, that's again massive amounts of power. And then in the third one, they leave because people are throwing rocks at them, and that doesn't seem to really make sense, does it? They just seem to. And they have no presence in the third one either, do they? I mean, it's like a Dalek episode where you see Daleks rolling down the corridor three times and that's it. Mm. You see one on the ship who hisses a bit. You see one in the pyramid who gets shot at.
He was deflating, not hissing. He's seen again after he hissed.
Well, that's
it. He's gone off like a balloon.
And then you have the third one, which is sitting in a chair. And then you have the fourth one, which has stuff thrown at him. And that's it, really. That's it for their entirety of the third act of that loose structure. It's a really, really, I can't get my head around what they were doing on that three-part structure. I don't understand where it was going. I don't understand the monks at all. Do you understand the monks at all? Does it make sense to you?
No, I don't, because a villain needs to have an end, doesn't it? It needs to be doing it for a reason. Otherwise, it is two-dimensional.
Yeah.
You know, did they want to drain the Earth of all its resources? Did they want to do like an Axos sort of thing? Or maybe mine the Earth's core and use that to power something? Or no, they just wanted everyone to worship them and think that they've been here forever. Well,
and what did they? I didn't quite understand. I know Mitzi started talking about this, but there was so much exposition I started to zone out.
Mm.
She sort of, what do, when, because they obviously go to planet because she says she's met them before.
Yeah.
When do they leave planets? I mean, surely if they once have got capitulation.
When the person that links them to the planet dies.
And then they go. And then they go. So when they die. I know, but then it says it goes down the bloodline.
Yes.
So in theory, you have to wait till the bloodline dies out and then they go. And then they head off. And as Missy points out, as I recall, they don't realize that it's probably the bloodline thing and just think it just finishes and then they head off. Which seems a sort of really sort of vague, unsciencey,
that's also a bit sort of accidental alien sort of thing as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
A bit like a fish in the Thames, that sort of thing.
But that's it. But then you have this before that, you have this very concise mapping out that they can observe and they see all of history as it maps out, and they do it. I got the suggestion they've been doing it since the dawn of time or dawn of human civilization. Or, you know, they've been doing it for a long time.
Well, they've had the capacity to look back and do it for that long anyway. Whether or not they actually started then is another matter entirely. But they've had the capacity.
I don't know. Yeah, that's
not clear. Yeah.
Nothing is clear about it. And I think for the audience, when you create a new villain and you try and make them big and then you don't deliver on anything. I think that's probably worse than anything else. This is that you feel like, well, what the hell have I been watching? There seems to be no rules here. And obviously you could make rules because it's fiction, so it's malleable. So you could always make rules. And I'm sure people in the comment section could say things like, when they have consent, they are incredibly depowered. So once they are rejected, they must leave, or they're monks. So they have a statute like a doctrine, which means that once they're rejected, they must leave. Or I'm sure there's loads of ways you could explain it, but it just wasn't present in the story. And I think that is the real problem. And especially, again, we've said this before, you know, everyone is quite happy to have multiple parties, but if they don't make for better stories, then no, I don't want them. And I don't know what the hell was happening there. As I said on Facebook to Elton, I think, you know, in the end, I think it'd be better if the first one was just a totally different story on its own, a standalone, and reworked. Because the idea of the book was quite a nice idea. Rework that as a standalone, that could have might have worked. But as a sort of beginning of something else, it felt like a waste. Mm. And I've made the second one the first part, and had the monks landing, and then made this one into two parts, like Sound of Drums and The Last of the Time Lords, which of course is a title which isn't at all like The Lay of the Land, but The Last of the Time Lords, and have that so it could have been expanded a bit, because it did feel rushed as well. You know, suddenly, you know, they meet at Pearl Mackie, Bill's house, and then they're off on a boat, and then they're on a boat, then the boat crashes into the dock, and then they get from the dock to London. And, you know, it's because there's just no time for it. There's clearly too much in there. Oh, and they shoot past the university. There's monks around there, but they don't notice them because the monks are utterly stupid now. They've obviously put their time thing away because that would have been kind of useful at this point. Would have been to still monitor time just to see what's happening. But no, we've got to forget about that because the story doesn't want us to talk about that anymore. That's no longer there. It's just like bizarro. But this is the problem. You can't do that. You can't sort of have Superman turn up, dominate the world, and then suddenly forget that he can dominate the world, or that he can fly, or that, you know, unless you tell us why. And there was none of that, and I think that's the problem, is all these things could be interconnected into some sort of mythology of the monks, but if you don't put those elements in there, it just becomes fragmented and the audience just think, this is fiction, this is not this doesn't make sense, you're not explaining what I need to know to buy into what you're telling me. So I think that was one of the major problems, wasn't it? I mean, I think there was many major problems, but I think that was purely the biggest one for me. Did you find, because some people disagreed with this, did you find, going back to my rather childish taunt on the fact that this is very similar to The Last of the Time Lords, did you feel that? Because some people have said they didn't.
Yeah, I think tonally, I think they must have, some of what they did must have done that on purpose. They must have been recalling it on purpose, because what Bill's wearing is similar to what Martha was wearing.
Well, some have said, well, one person said that they felt it was almost like an antithesis in the sense that she was the cause rather than the saviour to some degree.
Well, perhaps, yeah, there is that. But I think tonally, if you like the portrayal of a fictional dystopia, I think they got that quite right. They don't dwell on it too long. They just show stuff happening in a bit of a turn lefty sort of a way. So that part of it I liked. What I did not like was the Bill meeting the doctor scene, yes. Which went on for quite a while. Portrayed the doctor as both cruel and cowardly, even when it turns out that actually he hasn't gone bad. He's still quite cruel because she shoots him four times and he laughs at her.
Yes, it's a scene that looks like it's trying to be more than it actually is. It's a scene which I think sort of goes like, we really want to play this as if he has turned. We want the audience to believe he's turned, but we can't have him turn because we want him in the plot. So they get to a point where they can go no further. It's got to swing round. And I think a lot of the audience are a bit, I don't know. I mean, and I also find the fact that you intentionally did that regeneration bit almost as if you knew that you could use that in the teasers.
In the trailer, yeah.
And totally. Then tease people into it. And then I think if you're going to do that, which is absolutely fine, that's a good tease for audiences, but you've got to make it within the story feel like it has some sort of weight. In this, again, it was just like something he can do. It's my pretend regeneration. I've never done it before.
Exactly, yeah.
Could have been useful in several occasions to thwart or confuse my enemy into thinking that I was incapacitated. I'm pretending to regenerate. But no. This is the first time.
There's something else in there that doesn't make sense. That stands out, okay? I was talking to my dad about this, and he said he was waiting for John Sim to turn up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so was I, because these parallels with Last of the Time Lords, we find out that the monks have, got a telepathic network around the planet.
Yeah.
And then you think to yourself, is the master behind all of this? Because, you know, that might actually make some sense. Because he's got the technology to do what they want to do, what they're doing. And then the Doctor finds himself in this big sticky situation, having Mission Evolved and having the Master up to some... scenario. No, it's just the monks ambling around.
I mean, you could almost imagine...
pointing.
...the Doctor going into the vault and sitting with Missy and going, look, there's this issue. What's happened is there was this incident, and then for a few months, my companion was wandering around alone trying to create a rebellion, but not doing very well. And then she thinks, and I've been captured, and she's worried about me being captured. And then we meet, and then I think there's probably going to be this big network that's going on that's mentally controlling or affecting people that we're probably going to have to destroy with emotion. And Missy's going to go, no, you're misremembering. That's the time when I was the master. You know, that was Last the Time Lords. Remember, that's what I was doing. And then you sort of did that whole thing with the emotion, positive emotion, which broke the lock. And, you know, we had that whole period of time between when we started, end of the last story and the beginning of the first story, and things had changed. And Martha was wearing the same things as her. And, you know, it was very similar. And it was. And I did wonder for a second whether he was going to regenerate into John Sim and whether that was going to be a twist that was actually the master or something. Because I don't know how. I mean, we've already seen Tom Baker in the future. So I just kind of thought, was that going to be the swing? Because I kind of thought the regeneration was going to carry something meaningful.
Hmm.
Especially since the publicity office had obviously put a few notes down underneath Radio Times' doors to say, ramp up the fact that we're going to see something here that's going to be a game changer. Which I think was the fact that he doesn't regenerate.
I don't think Stephen Moffat knows what game changer means.
I think game changer means anything that gives us a little bit of publicity.
Oh, because I thought it was something. I thought game changer meant something that changes things considerably. I'm thinking back in 2011 with the split season.
Yeah.
And Moffat telling us that there's a game changing cliffhanger at the end of the first half of the season. Well, there wasn't.
No.
There was the episode before that, but there wasn't at the end of the season. So, yeah. But, shall we have a look at what Brian has to say about...
No, we won't.
We'll have a look at Facebook first.
Back in the box, Brian.
Jonathan
Almost
Roberts.
Out, back in. Yeah.
Jonathan Roberts, quite a disappointing episode for him. Not worth a 3-episode build-up. Pearl Mackie was quite wonderful. Trevor Arthur liked the concept of how the monks took over planets, got briefly excited by the Doctor regenerating. Pearl's manner of saving the day, I think Bill's there obviously, of saving the day was another weak solution to a seemingly impossible situation. I think it makes more sense than the Dobby Doctor thing. Back to Last of the Time Lords. It's a remake, isn't it? Because it's been foreshadowed earlier in the season, hasn't it?
Yes, that's true.
So I do think it works a bit better. I'm disappointed that it worked out that way. I'm still disappointed there weren't Cybermen, to be honest with you, because if they had been Cybermen, then that brings an interesting new dimension to the Cybermen, as we discussed in the last podcast. Basically, we're at the situation with the Truth Monks, brand new alien. Pretty much no one wants to see them again.
No.
Well, if it had been Cybermen, then obviously we want to see the Cybermen again, we want to see what they're going to do next. That would be an interesting new tactic for the Cybermen.
I'm
disappointed with the Truth Monks. I didn't want to be disappointed because, with the, the Da Vinci Code-esque Extremis episode, that was a really good, exciting way to get started. And obviously descended into sort of Matrix world. But, you know, there's something there that's interesting, and they've kind of been wasted.
Well, definitely. Because, I mean, I think in their name, the Truth Monks suggests that that should be their real focus. You know, that should be what defines them. And it really wasn't, apart from in the second episode, where, yeah, fair enough, that was to some degree what defined them. But they were still, in that definition, too caught up in their own machinery.
Mm.
That they weren't really, the truth was less about what the, who they were, but more what they wanted to get what they wanted, almost like a Nazi who needs to get to another room, has to go through a door, isn't it known as the door Nazi, because he has to go through the door to get to the other room. And it's, that's what the truth monks were. The monks weren't really that bothered about truth by the looks of it in the first episode or the last episode. It was just truth was the way of getting consent to get, was their door to conquest. And that seemed to be all there was. And that was, to me, a real issue, because they're not really truth monks. And I don't know what they were. And I kind of thought the third episode would actually tell us what they were, give us some idea, instead of this sort of vague, withery, slightly boring exposition, which Gomez is forced to chew out in the middle of the story.
Mm.
I mean, she had a nice scene at the end. I mean, I have a horrible feeling this is all going to be a ruse with her.
Of course it wasn't going to be, isn't it?
I'm kind of hoping it isn't, in the sense that, yeah, you can still bring her back to her own way, old ways in other ways. But if this is disingenuous, it's just too much her. Do you know what I mean? I like the idea that the master, if Missy is the master, having spent 70-odd years or whatever, 50-odd years, whatever, in that vault, having wanted to change, wasn't 1,000. She's there for 1,000, but they've only got 70 years through. There is signs of changes, and I quite like the way that she defines herself, that my sort of goodness would not be like your sort of goodness, which I find to be arrogant, egotistical, and self, you know. I thought, yeah, that's interesting. So there was.
It is interesting, yeah.
That was, I mean, it's interesting you said the other week, the difference between reviewing an episode straight after and having a few days, and I think this is a really good example of that, because when I came out of it, my feeling was just like, it was okay. It felt like things I'd seen before. It just ran along with itself, and then it ended. It didn't irritate me like Extremis, which, to be fair, was doing more interesting things, but just cocking them up, I think. I don't know, but it just seemed bland. And I kind of admired Extremis more for not being bland, for failing, but not being bland. But this just felt bland. But having a few days and then thinking, you know, the monks were just a mess, and this was just, to me, a structural copy of The Last of the Time Lords with no real dramatic impetus at the end. I mean, Last of the Time Lords, whether you find the whole Dobie and changing back to the Doctor and the rather awkward floating across the ship's scene annoying, you do have that nice play out with the Master and the Doctor at the end. You know, there is something dramatic there. The only thing I would say for it which was positive is that I didn't really feel that while this felt like a callback to Doctor Who of yore, that Bill or the Doctor still felt pretty consistent with the rest of the series.
Mm.
He wasn't overplaying his gaggy lines like he had been in Series 9. He wasn't overly unlikable as he could be in Series 8. I think it was a mistake putting Bill at the front. Because one of the things that had been so endearing about season 10 was the fact that she was playing quite a human role, that she was not the person who'd won the day. She was not the Clara or the amazing Amy or the fantastic Rose. She was more, well, you know, more like a Donna, I suppose, just someone who was along for the ride, who would bring their own human reflection to it. But then through this arc, that's changed again. And starting from the end of the last episode and into this episode, suddenly she becomes, you know, massively key integral figure, where we have the army coming to get her, sorry, the world leaders coming to get her services, and then her causing this problem which she alone must fix. It starts to fill back into that companion territory again, and that's a real shame.
Excuse me, yeah. The super companion.
Yeah, the super companion, which is what she hasn't been this season and not needed to be. So I'm really hoping that, I mean, it's obviously too late for Stephen since he's finishing, but I'm really hoping that Chris does listen to not just this podcast, but there's loads, I'm sure, saying similar things, and doesn't take it as a personal jab. There was a comment from Gatiss today or yesterday, which was a bit of a a bit of an irritant at what fans sort of seem to talk about. But I actually sort of see, cause I think fandom can be frustrating. I think it can want everything, and that's the problem. But that's because it's multiple voices. But I think there is things that you can learn from being on, because you're not on the same side of the fence, are you? And I think the sad thing for creators is that the audience are not on the same side as the fence of them, so they don't see the hard work and the issues and the logistics and the mistakes and the successes that you do. But equally, you don't see it as a television program being watched. And these sort of consistent things I see through a lot of people talking about this, articulate people, saying that this season was good, it felt different, that there was characters, they felt more like characters than before. You know, take that on board. You know, when you do your next series, oh, you're avoiding it now, I know, but, you know, I hope that that has been taken on board, that that is, I think, really where the show needs to be. Who knows? So, do you prefer this to last week's? You quite liked last week's, didn't you?
Yeah, I quite liked last week's.
I think I preferred last week's.
Yeah, I think I preferred last week's as well. What did Brian Terranova think?
I don't know. Shall we move on? Just...
Shall we move on, to the next conversation?
Yeah, well, I was just thinking we could just put him in the box again. I'm quite enjoying putting him in the box. I'll give you a clue, listener. He starts his first sentence with overall. If you can guess the rest, we'll tell you the rest next week.
Well, do you know, there's been a few sad things happened.
No, wait. I think we do have to read this email out. We can't ignore it now.
I was
joking, because it will sound really desperate to the rest of it if it's right at the end of the book.
Indeed, yes. So Brian says, shall I do the voice? No, I won't do the voice.
No.
Overall, I felt this three-parter was maybe the second weakest story of this series. As a whole, it was an okay story. It worked, but it had far too many elements that pulled me out of the story due to their over-the-top nature or just plain awful concepts. I felt that the fake regeneration was a waste because Bill doesn't even know about regeneration or what it looks like. Good point, Brian. Yes, I was thinking that at this time. It was there only as a fake-out for the audience. Bill would have felt the same way just seeing the Doctor lying dead from his gunshot wounds. Part one of this story started with an actor from Turn Left, and the final part played out with themes from Turn Left. It felt like we were trotting on old ground again so soon. That said, the concept of the monks themselves works well, so long as they are not Cybermen, in my opinion. They are an interesting concept and a nice new addition to Who lore. Missy was good in this story, as Michelle Gomez usually is, but her being locked in the vault is a major waste. Especially with the audience knowing it so soon, and worse still, that the Doctor knew the whole time. Missy would have been better served working with the monks like Delgado would have in the past, although saying that, she could still be. The series isn't over yet. Bill saving the day with memories or idealised memories of her mother is like Clara saving things the day with her memories of her parents through the leaf she carried within Series 7. Yes, forgotten all about that.
Yeah, I've seen a few people say that.
Now, Doll, as a comedic relief in general, but more so for this story, just doesn't work. His character is just the wrong tone for the show. Comedy can be had without the character themselves having to be stupid or idiotic. Also, why exactly did the Doctor take 6 months to save the day? Maybe I missed that. If so, bad on me. Lastly, Bill talking to a mom is like Sherlock's head palace. I don't hate the concept. In fact, I like it better than the mind palace, but it's like Moff is a one-trick pony. Well, do you know, I bridle at that thought.
Yeah.
Thank you for the pun. Also,
I don't know.
Back to what you said earlier.
I thought it was a pretty stable one.
Oh, I really want to see the Target adaptation of Doctor Who and the Door Nazi.
The Door Nazi? Yeah. It's... Stare Nazi. No, I was thinking Stare Nazis is what the Daleks were. No, they weren't, were they? They were the opposite.
So Brian makes some good points there.
He does. The reason it takes Doctor 6 months is because he's spending all that time slowly securing pointless soldiers on that ship.
That's right, yeah. One of those soldiers looked familiar. I can't think who it was, though.
I think I agree with Nadal. I think Nadal is a fine character. I think I'd be very happy to have him in this series with Matt Lucas if they just wrote him, as I think he's crying to be written, and that's as not as a comic relief. He doesn't need to be a comic relief. And
he needs to be a little bit more consistent as well.
And that's why
he's not that consistent as a character.
So he keeps dropping back into comic relief mode. The comic relief with Nadal is how the Doctor treats him. That's all you need. Like in the previous episode, I think it was in Oxygen, where he sort of berates the Nadal for letting him do what he's about to do. That sort of thing is where the comic relief with Nadal can exist. He doesn't have to be playing a Matt Lucas character, and it kind of feels as if when he's being written, they're thinking Matt Lucas, not Nadal. You know, what would be funny to see Matt Lucas do? And I just don't think he needs to be doing that. So, yeah, I think the character's right. I just think the way they write him, I think Brian's right, is the wrong tone. And it certainly didn't work in this episode for me at all. Yeah, and there's a couple of his jokes are just beyond awful. The rest of it's good. I mean, with the monks, again, I'm surprised he thought they were an interesting addition. Although I would agree that having Missy work with the monks would have at least given the monks some sort of structure.
Really giving her something to do beyond exposition as well, or beyond static lying on a piano exposition.
Yeah, absolutely. The only thing I would say about the scene, which is quite, is sort of pushing the idea that the master has her own life too. And he's doing all sorts of things other than just following the doctor around, which we all assume, but it's nice to see it sort of mentioned that she has her own stories. But no, it just felt very poorly put together. I'm just very surprised, really, at this, because as we've said before, the first five episodes, was it?
Yeah.
Were really so strong. Not necessarily all brilliant, as people have said, and I totally get that, but they tonally felt the same. The characters felt well written, and they hung together well. And then we get to this one, and it just feels like, I just wonder whether it was just too big for them. It was too big to sort of take three different writers, pull them together to create a consistent storyline with a new monster, which clearly had no origins or ethos established. And it was just too big for them to do, and it ended up having to fall back onto old ideas.
Overnight viewing figures for Lie of the Land were a disappointing 3 million, 3.01 million, share of 15% of the total TV audience. Now, because of geopolitical reasons, the Britain's Got Talent final was moved from Sunday night to Saturday night, which meant that Doctor Who was on the opposite Britain's Got Talent final. Right. So that topped the day with 8.19 million people watching. So that's not so good. However, Lie of the Land gets an AI of 82, which I think is in keeping with the previous two episodes of the storyline.
Interesting, though, because as someone who watches Doctor Who a lot, I thought it was pretty poor, but it's interesting that those who tend to just watch it casually were quite okay with it. So, yeah. Again, it's always hard to tell, isn't it? I still think as a construct, there's been issues in these last three, regardless of whether people enjoyed them or not. I still think there were issues that could have improved it.
I think I'm just looking at the reactions that have been compiled on DoctorWhoNews.net, and they're pretty much exclusively talking about Pearl Mackey.
Right, in a positive.
In positive, yeah.
Good.
None of these reviews seems to like the episode itself particularly. The Radio Times felt the episode to be misjudged in getting the companion to fire a gun at the Doctor.
Well, I kind of thought that was a bit gutsy. I thought that was okay. Because if you give her the situation that she was in, she makes a call, which, to be fair, once she does it, looks like she instantly regrets. So if she'd shot him and then looked like victorious, I think that might have been a problem. But it looked like someone who was desperate, who was being pushed to a point where she could see no other options. So I didn't really have any issue with that at all. I think if you put yourself into her position, where you are responsible, you've waited 6 months for this person to save you, and suddenly he's one who's going to perpetuate it further, you might feel you have no other choice. You might even feel so guilt-ridden that you feel that you deserve the burden of being the murderer. Mm. I don't know. But I know I didn't have any issue with that. I'm surprised. It was a bit brutal, maybe, for kids, but which is probably why the tone jumps and becomes so light after it, because he is a bit Series 9-y after it when he jumps back up and he's all excited. Not very much like Series 10, but that might have been to try and counterpoint the seriousness of having the companion shoot.
Okay. So that was another thing.
I think that was another thing that I felt devalued the monks, is that all that situation, which was like, what, about an 8-minute scene? Mm-hmm. And the monks were on that ship. And okay, they'd not been called. He'd called the galley. But still, the monks were on that ship, utterly oblivious to this massively long expositional issue with gunshots being fired as well. Again, not even a mini time checking version, you know, one that just sort of doesn't give you the details in virtual reality, just sort of like a diary, which just brings up the basic things that are going to be happening.
In a room which we know has cameras, and we know that the truth monks are adept at viewing cameras.
So, and they just do nothing. And again, that just weakens them even further. And I couldn't believe it. I was just thinking, you know, surely any villain would have popped down by now. And this happens a lot. I was watching Wonder Woman last night.
Oh, was it good?
I really enjoyed it. I think there's a lot to be said to it. But it does do as this does, where it does, for the sake of the story, puts other key things which the story has suggested is there to create the tension on hold to allow that bit to play out. So you could be on an enemy army camp and having this big ruckus in the corner, but no one comes over to find out what's going on because the story doesn't want it, because the story wants to have this nice bit of personal fight, challenge, chat, talk, reconcile thing going on. You know, it doesn't want the rest of the camp to know at this point, but the story wants the rest of the camp to be there, the rest of the points, because it adds the tension and the threat, but then conveniently doesn't want it when it doesn't need it. And you seem to get that a lot, and I really have issue with that, because it feels like it feels you could say it's a natural conceit for audiences to allow them to have the drama of the moment, but it kind of feels like you're playing a very childish game. You know, you shouldn't be able to create a situation through tension and then ignore the tension because it suits what you want to do now. And that's sort of kind of what that scene was. Builds up the threat of the monks, builds up the threat they're stuck on the ship alone with them, builds up this threat they're in this room that could be brought, the monks could come in any time, and then the monks don't notice them because it doesn't suit the moment, because it doesn't suit what the story wants. And as a lot, some people have said that, you know, we've got to be careful, you shouldn't blame Moffat for this because he wasn't the key writer. And I think that's, you know, these are to some degree, but he was involved, he was most likely the script editor. He most likely commissioned the story frameworks. And ultimately, you know, if you're going to be the showrunner and you're going to be the one who takes credit for a show, you're ultimately going to be the one who takes the flak as well.
Definitely. So speaking of showrunners and taking the flak, it is been revealed in the last few days that although Class has not been officially axed, Patrick Ness will not be involved with it if it does return.
It's interesting.
Indeed. So read into that what you will, dear listener.
It's hard to know actually what to read. Is this Ness not happy, or is this them not happy with his work? Could be either way. So it did okay in BBC America, didn't it?
Apparently so, yeah. It's doing okay. I think it's still on in BBC America. But they seem quite pleased with it.
Which I think is probably the reason it's carried on, because I got the impression the BBC were not exactly thrilled with its successes on BBC Three, and not exactly thrilled that they had to sort of push it out onto the terrestrial linear channels as agreed. So I imagine the BBC...
Not that many people knew it was on.
Oh, that was it, because they thought it was a dead duck. So it was just a matter of fulfilling the policy. But so I think if you're American and you've enjoyed Class, you might find that you guys are the ones who might have saved it to live another day.
Thanks. Yeah. Sad news.
Yeah, thanks.
Sad news on the podcast for the K. Peter Sallis has passed away. Now, he's well known for a particular show and an Oscar-winning movie series. His links to Doctor Who are nearly twofold. He played Penley in the Ice Warriors back in 1967, and he was due to appear in Enlightenment in 1983, but the strike action delayed filming, and he was replaced by Keith Barron. But he's best known, Peter Sallis. Well, it depends how old you are and where you live. In the UK, he's best known as Norman Clegg in Last of the Summer Wine, which we've mentioned on the podcast with numerous occasions in the past because I like it. I particularly like the early episodes, which shows a much sort of a very 1970s grimy post-war, because a lot of parts of Yorkshire were very much, you know, they barely moved in 20, 30 years. Back in the 1970s, early episodes of Last of Summer Wine, very interesting pieces of sort of social history and social commentary for the UK. Later on, sort of 1980 sort of period onwards, it got very sort of light and summery and whimsical. And cleaned up a bit as well, just like the area where they film it, which seemed to get a lot tidier. But yeah, if you ever stumble upon those older episodes, it's quite fascinating. So yeah, he played Clegg in Last of Summer Wine from beginning to end and appeared in every single one of the 295 episodes between 73 and 2010. And of course, he has been involved in the Oscar-winning series of movies from Aardman Animations, of the Wallace and Gromit films. Because he was the voice of Wallace. Which is just... He's one of those people who just seem very quiet and nice and just normal.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I was never a fan of Last of Summer Wine like you were. Primarily because it was the unfunniest show on television at the time. Can't help
I think it's very hard to get three old people into amusing situations without the use of stuntmen and bad editing, to be honest with you.
And without the use of a funny bone.
The early episodes are a lot more amusing in dialogue terms. I think around the time of Thora Heard, when she came into that time, around 1987, I think that's, might have been a bit earlier, might be 1985. I think that's when it changed a bit. I mean, the dialogue seemed a lot difficult, a lot more forced, I think. I don't know if I'm right by that. Then again, it might simply be because Roy Clark was working on Keeping Up Appearances as well at the same time. So perhaps he was saving his funny lines for Hyacinth Bouquet. I don't know. I just know I find it funnier in the 70s episodes. I think work a lot better.
I mean, I never found it funny ever in my life. There was still for me something quite charming about it, maybe because I grew up with it being on Sunday nights or whenever it was, and it was, you know, it's a very gentle, slightly misogynistic possibly comedy, I don't know, but it was of its time. And yeah, there's something odd about British comedy where when it's not funny, there is often some sort of, there is something it's saying underneath it, or there is some sort of social class, or there's some discourse in there, isn't there, that's being played on. So even when it's not funny, you still feel that there is something slightly of value there, I guess. And I always thought Peter Sallis was one of those who brought it. He's especially because he normally had to play the fairly straight character.
Yeah.
He sort of, for me, when I used to watch, he used to ground it and make it watchable because I found him quite a believable person while Compo was, you know, just a vaguely absurd character who every episode would find some excuse to fall into the stream at the end of the boat. But yeah, no, that's my thing for Sallis, is I think he did do a lot for that show. And even though I didn't find the show funny, I think it did sort of have some sort of interesting resonance, as you say, especially for Yorkshire.
Yeah, I think a conversation with Gareth Cavanna and myself, this is in one of the coaxials, I think I declared that Last of Some Wine is basically the Yorkshire version of Coronation Street. that's bit sad news there. Unless we're going to talk about an original Ice Warrior head being found, which seems very apt timing-wise. It could only have been better timing if it had been this week rather than last week, to be honest.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So we'll just have to see who's writing next week's. Who's wrote it?
Who's written it?
Yes.
Who's written it? The Empress of Mars?
Yes.
No idea. Don't you know?
No.
It's Mark Gatiss.
It is Mark Gatiss. I wondered whether that's why he was on the Radio Times. I think it was Radio Times. Complaining about fans just before, perhaps sort of preparing himself for the barrage of things that will be said about his episode, good or bad.
I think visually it looks very good.
I'll be interested to see what he does. I'd just be interested. Here's to say, I have a love-hate relationship with his work. Sometimes I really like it. Sometimes it really does nothing for me. It's a tough one. So it's I'm interested to see what he does, and I'm hoping that he brings it back on track after his three-parter and carries on what's being done in this series so well, which I think he should, because he does well. I tend to feel that he is not one of those sort of gagathon writers like Stephen Moffat's very good at, where every moment has to be a joke to keep the audience amused sort of thing. And Moffat can do that brilliantly. He's very fast, he's quick-witted, and he writes very fluid sort of comedy like that, but I still never feel that really serves the show in abundance, and Gatiss doesn't tend to do that in his scripts, so maybe his scripts will actually fit this quite nicely this season. Maybe. I mean, I'm just thinking of the what was it, Cold Breath, the the first Ice Warrior one, what was it called? I can't remember.
Cold Storage. No,
Cold War.
Cold War. Yeah.
Cold War.
Cold War.
I could imagine in this season, that would have fitted in quite well.
Fitted
the tone. Yeah, I can't do as good one as Roten. Fitted it quite well this series. That feels so. Maybe his work will really work in this the vibe of season 10.
So maybe.
Maybe.
Maybe it's difficult to say. I think visually, what we've seen so far of it is. If you haven't seen the photos yet, I dare say they'll be online.
I thought some of the FX actually for Lie of the Land was kind of ropey. Some of the imposed statues looked really.
There was definitely some things that didn't work.
Which is unusual for this series, which has been very consistent. I think that was a bit which just didn't quite. I'm hoping that it'll be good. I'm hoping that. It will work, and we'll be back on track again.
Yeah, there seems to be a John Carter aspect to it, from what we've seen. Did you see the John Carter movie?
I did, unfortunately.
Right.
I'd read the books, so right, I was a little miffed that I felt that they'd got the movie totally wrong, as you do when you feel close to the source material.
Yeah, sure.
You feel it's a bit like that?
I mean, thematically, you've got, it's 19th century Mars and there's humans there. So, there's that aspect of it. I'd like to see what they do with it. I hope it works well. I hope there was 19th century humans on Mars in the .2 universe.
Well, we will find out, I am sure. I suppose that adds a little colour. Just have to see. Did you see the article by... Gatiss, the on radio.
I've had a browse through it whilst we've been chatting.
So I'm just wondering whether there's something in there that he is sort of preempting, something that he feels fans are going to.
Having always been one of those viewers, and also having been in my time a militant fanboy, I don't give a monkey's, Gatiss told RadioTimes.com and other journalists, because it's not about that. The people who complain if something contradicts the wheel in space are always going to watch the show in order to complain about it. You only have to worry about the people who didn't know that the show existed before 2010, or even 2016, effectively. It's ancient history. 6 months is ancient history in television terms. I mean, there's no point in being perversely cruel and say, I'm going to totally rewrite the history of the Daleks, he added, unless you come up with an idea which is startlingly brilliant. It's all one big happy thing, surely, should be, and you shouldn't fret about stuff like that. That's why we sit around tables in pubs arguing about things, and people always have. It's quite fun, and you'll always find a way.
You see, but there I think he contradicts himself. Because to some degree, the fact that people do carry a certain amount of, let's say, anal fixation onto continuity is sometimes what creates great ideas. And certainly with Doctor Who, and certainly him and Stephen's tenure, if we put Gatiss in with Moffat, which is probably a little unfair because he was working before it, but so both of them were, they have both done that, especially his colleague, Mr. Moffat, has done a lot of stories being reworked round past continuity. You can't sort of say, we shouldn't be bothered about what happens in the past. We should only be bothered what's happening now in season 10. And then write entire massive convoluted stories that are evolved all about what happened in the past, like with Genesis of the Daleks, or having Clara shoot through time and affect everyone, or, you know, River Song and her multiple change, you know, all this sort of stuff. And even then you could sort of go, well, why did we need a police box? Because the police box in the end only matters to people who watched the show, you know, 30 years ago. The new people didn't need to see it. So I think you've got to be careful with that argument. I think it can be quite self-destructive. I know what he's trying to say, that nothing should be entirely sacrosanct. And I agree with that. You know, if you've got a great idea, you shouldn't feel you can't do it because you're chased by the stories of the past. And that's why, as we've said before, the Time War was such a good gate, which meant you could keep the past as it was, but explore new territory. But yeah, I can see where his frustration is. At the same time, I don't think he's being a bit a little over general and a little dismissive as to the very nature of critics and fandoms, you know, including himself, I'm sure. Because even I remember, I think in St. Anthony's Fire, he references the fact that the TARDIS shell keeps changing shape, but it's now suddenly got a St. John's badge on it. You know, that's the sort of thing that only fans would indulge in and fans would reference and know. And if you're appealing to those fans, I just don't know. There's something about it which frustrates me. I don't like that idea. Again, that very crass comment that if they've been with us for all this time and they know all this stuff, we don't need to worry about them because they're going to watch it anyway. And you think, I don't know if I like that. That's a very dismissive thing to say. You know, if our football manager said that. We only need to worry about selling new tickets because the old fans are going to come anyway. So, you know, it doesn't matter really. I don't know. Do you know what I mean? It just, there's something about it. And yet at the same time, I sort of kind of understand where his frustration is coming from.
Yes. Yes. Well, I wouldn't say it's an easy place to be, having been a fan writer, a fan actor, and then being a writer and actor and involved in the development of the show. So, and you know, we all grow up, don't we? We all change our thoughts about Doctor Who. You know, in 1989, I was a little more tolerant of Doctor Who than I had been 2 years previously with Time of the Rani. These days, I'm still not keen on Time of the Rani, but I really enjoy the 1989, partially, and to some degree the 1988 episodes of Doctor Who. Back in 2005, I was not particularly keen on Russell T Davies' recreation of Doctor Who in many ways. In fact, I wrote a book about it called Ultimate Regeneration, in which the ongoing commentary throughout there, which is interspersed with reviews from the website that shall not be named, kind of details how I came more to terms and kind of got what Russell T Davies was doing with the show. So that's, you know, that's a journey of 5 years from 2005 to 2010. So I think we always change and evolve our feelings and opinions about things. So maybe that's Mark Gatiss after three glasses of wine.
Could be. I mean, as I say, I watched, you know, as I said the other week, a couple of Matt Smith episodes, which I enjoyed a lot more this time round than I did when I watched them. I would still say that I thought they were perfect, but I found them more enjoyable with a bit of distance. I think you can do. But I think there is a fact that I think one of the reasons that fans become quite possessive about continuity to some degree is because that continuity serves them in their investment and belief and their attempt to involve and immerse themselves in the fiction.
Yeah.
Because that's ultimately why we like callbacks and continuity, because it's a way of, as we've said this before, of trying to assert, trying to in our heads mentally connect two points which are really hard to mentally connect.
Yeah, and it reassures that there is a consistent universe
as
well. Yeah,
absolutely. It creates that universe. It's world building, and it's also about that immersion. Because, you know, Doctor Who in 1963 is hard to sort of really account in Doctor Who in 2017. They're very, very different looking. So, as you say, the continuity references and this sort of strong continuity gives, as you say, that people that feeling that it's real, and that helps them invest. And not in a sort of merciless way, but in a way that's how they get their enjoyment. That's how they get their investment, is feeling that, as you say, this is a real world. So there is that, but ultimately, yeah, I think one of the beautiful things about Doctor Who is that it's time travel, time changing, so you can have a bit of flexibility. But I would still say I think you've got to be mindful of where and how and what you change. A bit like, I suppose, like Doctor Who likes to say these days with its fixed points in time and space. Maybe in continuity, to some degree, there are fixed points that you don't really meddle with because they are nexuses for the audience's or long-term audience's pleasure. A nexi, absolutely. And you say, I mean, he sort of makes a comment about 2000 people from 2010, but 2010 will be establishing the same nexi, and that might include the War Doctor. It might include, you know, not destroying Gallifrey. It might include, you know, something to do with Clara. And if you suddenly in 5 years' time, so that gives you legitimacy to start sort of knocking that, you know, changing all that because it suits a new story of yours. You know, you are altering that, so those nexis that are grounding that new viewer. It's a bit of pull and give and pull, isn't it, really? Everything should be sacrosanct. But I think, like we've said before, I think Moffat's sort of making it Clara who sort of urges Hartnell to the right TARDIS, and, you know, River Song has suddenly met all the other doctors. And I think as soon as you start doing that, I think you do start interfering a little bit on those nexis, and you are going to get a bit of abrasion. But if you're doing things like Gatiss has done, which largely are sort of small little tweaks to, say, the Ice Warrior's code, an embellishment there. He's got the Ice Warrior Queen, is it, in this one? Things like that, you know, they're fair game. That is about world bringing. That's world building. So I think it depends on what you're doing.
Agreed. Yeah, agreed. Which, on that kind of positive, constructive note, brings us to the end of this week's podcast with a K. If I sound a little bit toothy, it's because I've got a filling in, which I'm just getting used to. Big thanks to James McLean and to Brian Terranova for taking the time to send an email. We'll be back next week. We'll play you out with this trailer from the next episode of Doctor Who, the title of which I've temporarily forgotten. Until then, it's goodbye.
Mars, 1881.
Doctor Who on BBC One.
This is a Beyond Casterbrus podcast. Available on iTunes, Audio Boom, Stitcher.com, Player FM, and BeyondCasterbrus.com.